Happy endings are few and far between, and also, defined by, what's happy for somebody else isn't always happy for that person.
That was Chris Anade, and this is a very belated Purser Explores the World. Well, here we are again. It's only been, what, a year and 3 months since the last episode? Barely any time at all. I suppose you might be wondering what happened. Well, honestly, life got in the way. Work and everything else basically combined to make podcast making a bit of a time luxury that I couldn't afford at the time. But that was then and this is now, so on with the show. When I'd finally decided that I could afford the time and effort to start podcasting again, I started looking around at the various topics I thought might be interesting covering. I built up quite a list, but the one that really caught my eye as a first off was a project by New York-based photographer Chris Anade called Faces of Addiction. I won't go into detail about the project here, that's what the interview's for, but I thought I would give you a little background about why I picked it. When I was 18, 19, I went through a bad patch. I was in a bad place emotionally and mentally, and that ended up living on the streets for a little while. It wasn't anyone's fault, it was just a thing that happened. During my time on the streets, I met people, mostly kids, because, 18, 19, who were dealing with drug addictions, family violence, racism, sexual assault, gender dysfunction, pimples, the need for education, the list goes on and on. But for most of them, when you boiled it all down, the real problem was that society had started treating them like things. Broken objects that people and governments would prefer just didn't exist. But they weren't just broken things to be tossed away. They were human beings trying to survive in two societies. One that had decided they were broken and worthless, but still demanded that they adhere to all societal rules. And the other, which accepted them with all their problems, but carried within it an internalized violence and a Lord of the Flies Darwinism that meant anyone trying to leave was going to struggle. I could tell you about the young Aboriginal woman who was working to get herself a childcare qualification so that she could get off the streets, start working, and start providing for her kid. Or the young gay guy who came into the shelter I was staying at with half his face bashed in because some thugs had decided to go and do a bit of gay bashing down at the Wall, which is a well-known location in Darlinghurst, Sydney, for where both male and female sex workers, street prostitutes, worked. Or I could tell you about the 16-year-old girl pregnant with twins who was still using heroin. But I won't, because Chris Anade's Faces of Addiction tells stories like this so much better. His photographs, his blog, it conveys the sense that these people are still human, still underneath everything else, all their problems. They're still people who are trying to do the things that people do. They're trying to live, they're trying to love, they're trying to understand what's going on. In other words, Chris's project returns humanity to them.
Before we go into Faces of Addiction, you started out doing a physics degree.
Well, that's correct.
You then did what most people who do maths-based degrees did and went into finance.
Right.
So,
when I did it, it wasn't a common thing to do. But I guess now it's more common to do it. When I did it, it was pretty rare for people to do that.
Mm-hmm. So you were basically the hipster. You were doing it before it.
there are a few people before me, obviously, a lot more. it was relatively rare back then.
So then you spent a number of years on Wall Street.
Correct.
Doing the whole thing. I mean, mind you, my experience of Wall Street is basically from the Eddie Murphy and what's his name movie.
Trading Places.
Trading Places.
The best Wall Street. I always say that's the best Wall Street movie there is.
I think it's great. And then you decide to actually take a break from that and go and have a look at what's the suburb place? What's the place that you go to?
It's called Hunts Point. It's a neighborhood in the Bronx.
Yeah. So what makes you decide to go to Hunts Point?
You know, I've been asked that many times. I'm not sure I have a good answer. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry to say. It was a combination of, I had always, prior to that, my form of relaxation was always about walking around New York, just going on, really very long walks, 20-mile walks, and just kind of exploring. And, there was some level of disenchantment on my part with Wall Street, mm-hmm. how it handled the crisis and the crisis and how the culture of banking had changed over my 20 years. And I just had not been to, I didn't know the Bronx very well. I don't know if you know New York City very well, but there are basically five different sections in New York City that are relatively different, very different. There's Manhattan, which everybody knows, and there's Brooklyn, Bronx, Queens, Staten Island, and I knew all the others. I just didn't know the Bronx. So mm-hmm. on my time off, my weekends off, I just started walking in the Bronx. And when I told someone I was doing this, they said, "Whatever you do, don't go to Hunts Point." So of course, I went to Hunts Point. and I had been told that by multiple people. "Oh no, it's the worst neighborhood in New York. It's got the highest crime and blah blah blah." The very first second, within the first day that I spent there walking around, I guess I was a little mystified why people said don't go here. It seemed to have a very, the stereotypes were so much, not surprisingly wrong. And I enjoyed the neighborhood because people were very friendly, and it was so much different than what I was seeing on Wall Street. And so I started going back more and more. And at some point, the neighborhood does have a problem with addiction,
mm-hmm.
And prostitution. And throughout my walks, eventually, some of the people who live on the street, some of the homeless people, just started talking to me, and I got to be close to them. And was drawn in. And so the initial stage was just simply personal. It was people, a culture of street addiction that I hadn't known anything about. And I found the people involved to be people I got along with very well. There was never intention of a project. It was just people, where I wanted to spend my time getting, both out of curiosity and also just people I got along with. And then eventually, I started getting more political about it and realizing that what I was seeing was, so much different than what was out there in the media. And that made me want to kind of tell some of the stories and, their stories, or help them tell their stories.
Mm. So at what point did you say, okay, what I want to do is a photo essay or basically document these people's stories by camera?
That was probably a year into it. I was taking pictures, and, it kind of happened by accident in some ways because of the nature of how I was, I was just putting things on Flickr.
Mm.
And they have, you can group them by albums. And so I said, I got this kind of grouping of people who, and I had to put a name to it. And I'm like, what is uniform about them is their addiction. So that's why I just kind of, at that point, it kind of morphed into a project without me really thinking about it as being such. And it wasn't about until a year after first meeting, was walking into Hunts Point, that it kind of took the idea that, hey, this is something I really want to commit my time to and kind of think about it in a structured way.
So coming from the very different world where you have your Wall Street, and all of a sudden you're immersed in this whole different culture, this whole different society, how did that affect you?
Quite a bit. I wasn't entirely naive about, you know, about, I mean, my dad was an anthropologist. We spent a lot of our life traveling. You know, it was pretty common for, you know, I think a friend of mine had said about me that, and I would say it about my father as well, which was, we are both happiest when we're in places we shouldn't be, or people tell us we shouldn't be. So, you know, if the door says do not enter, I tend to enter. But you know, there was this really odd period of probably a year, that first year, when I was spending my days on Wall Street, and then, you know, I would, if I had a time, if I got home early enough from work, I'd go up, spend my nights in Hunts Point, and then spend my weekends there. And there was the overlap was got to be too jarring, where I had to choose which one to do. And I chose to do the photography. And it just comes down to a simple fact that that's where I was happier. You know, it's, in that sense, it was relatively selfish of me. I mean, I just chose where I enjoy, what I enjoyed doing more. And, you know, I enjoyed being in Hunts Point more than I enjoyed being on Wall Street.
So the people that you, I mean, you tell a lot of people's stories through your work, through your blog. You've told them through, you've had stories on The Guardian, you've had stories all over the place. Now, you concentrate on a couple of people. Now, you've told us a story of Beauty lately. Now, the last, just to catch up on the listeners, Beauty was a woman who'd spent a couple of years in Hunts Point, but last December, she'd gone back to Oklahoma?
Right. I have an agreement with everybody I work with. I choose my words carefully. I call them my friends. I have agreement with everybody that, and they know this, that if they ever want out, if they ever want, I will drive them wherever they want and give them, you know, pay for the drive, and then leave them, you know, with $100, let's say, to set them up. I don't care what, you know, if they're really committed to getting out, because I believe the only way to really get clean when you're a street addict is just to go someplace else.
Go where the drugs aren't.
Yeah, correct. Because their entire family, a lot about being a street addiction is a valid culture. It's as strong a culture as any place else. And it's very, very hard to get clean if you're a street addict, because the only people you know are other addicts. They're your family, your street family. And so the only really way to get clean is to go somewhere else. And it's hard to do. Regardless, everybody knows that that's my offer, and I've done it before. And so I had told her, you know, I repeated to her, because I know she was in a bad way. She was looking worse than usual. I said to her, you know, look, I have some free time. I said, you know, I know your mother is now in a better place than she was ever before. She's clean. She was a crack addict herself, her mother. And I said to her, I said to Beauty, I know your mother, and you're communicating again with your mother. You know, if you want to go home, I'll drive you. And, you know, this is a 1,500-mile drive, three-quarters away across the country. Her mother lives in Oklahoma City, and I said, look, be at the McDonald's, you know, in Hunts Point on the day after Christmas at 9 in the morning. I said this around Thanksgiving time, like 2 months prior. She showed up. And so I drove her. I drove her to Oklahoma City to be with her mother.
But sadly, there wasn't a really happy ending to that one.
No, there wasn't. And, you know, I probably knew that going in, that this necessarily wasn't going to end well in terms of how we think things end well. But that nonetheless, it could. And it's what she wanted, and it's what her mom wanted, and you know, it was a worthwhile to give it a shot. But you know, it didn't end well, because again, that it didn't end well, and is kind of looking at it from our perspective. I mean, someone who's not a street addict, you know, it's very hard to leave street addiction. Because it's everything you know, and it's all, in many cases, all you have. So although going home was helpful. You know, her past had kind of caught up with her because she New York State had some warrants on her and flew out there and took her back to New York.
Mm. I believe there was a charge for selling. Later.
Sorry?
There was a charge for selling something called K2. So I had actually heard of I hadn't actually heard of K2 before I started reading your stories.
Yeah, K2 is a pretty nasty drug, and it's actually now kind of getting popular amongst kids here in New York. It's a very, very bad drug. It's also called, I believe in England they're calling it Spice. I don't know if that's what they call it in Australia, or they just made it to Australia. She uses K2, which is legal to buy in bodegas here, or semi-legal, and it's in a nebulous area. But she had an old charge from in New York. She had a charge, a felony charge for a sale. That sounds more shocking than probably it is, because almost everybody, almost everybody who's an addict has a felony warrant for selling. It's just the cops hand them out like candy.
Yep.
I guess what was shocking to me was, and many others, is that when she got to Oklahoma, she turned herself in because she had some. The last time she had been in Oklahoma was 6 years ago, and she turned herself in on some very minor charges from 6 years ago to try to clean up her record, to try to do things right. And they found it. Then New York came and took her back.
That's a real shame.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
So just to clarify, the last thing that I read about Beauty was in April, where she was still in Rikers. Have you had any contact with her lately?
She did get out. We got her out through a bunch of lobbying, and she stayed. She's back on the streets again.
Okay.
It doesn't have a happy ending, but... Mm. You know, happy endings are few and far between, and also, you know, defined by, you know, what's happy for somebody else isn't always happy for that person.
Mm.
She feels she's in a good place.
Mm. So what keeps
may not
you
be
going?
What other people think. Sorry.
What keeps you going? I mean, I've spent a little bit of time on the streets in my youth. I was, spent 6 months on the streets. I've had some experience with that culture. But what keeps you keeping going with this sort of thing? I mean, from our point of view, from a comfortable point of view, there aren't a lot of happy endings. This can get very depressing. So,
I think it's, I count many of the people involved as my friends. And so what keeps me going is the relationships there. Mm. First and foremost, but anybody who has had a relationship with, as a father or as a child of, an addict can tell you how taxing it can be on that person.
Mm.
It's very hard to maintain a friendship with an addict. But it's still fulfilling in many different other ways. There's a political side. I mean, I am a political person, and I do feel at times that, the need for an advocacy. So I feel like it's worthwhile from that side standpoint to keep doing it, to remind people of the issues. It does get depressing, but so much of life can be depressing. So, I've never really found myself, if I'm on a beach with a book and a drink, I'm usually pretty bored. So
that's back to being where you shouldn't be, isn't it?
Right. Exactly.
So, okay. Well, where do you go from here? I mean, you're going to continue taking the photos, continue telling these people's stories. Do you have any plans for anything else, more advocacy work?
I think in the Bronx, I physically moved upstate.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to broaden my focus. And so I'm trying to put it all together. It was kind of 4.5 years to 5 years in the Bronx. I'm trying to put together perhaps in a book. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
and I still maintain, you know, I've kind of narrowed it down to, sadly, through deaths and just circumstances, to four or five people I keep in touch with regularly.
Mm.
You know, focus more on kind of the long term, what happens over them over 5 years, you know, over continually. But I plan to do a project. You know, I'm putting out a call for people across the United States to, I'm going to kind of drive across the United States and listen to stories and take pictures of people who are still in addiction or former addicts throughout the country.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of a geographical broadening, with, instead of doing, you know, 5 year studies, 5 years of 10 people, I'd kind of do a 50 states of 50 people for just, mm-hmm. you know, kind of 2 days and spend time with people. And so I'm going to kind of do that probably in starting the New Year's. Just basically drive around country and show that addiction is, you know, not just confined to the Bronx, but, you know, it's relatively, it's pretty much everywhere, both geographically and economically.
So thanks to Chris for taking the time. It took a couple of attempts to line things up, mostly because of a cold that I had that just would not let go. In fact, you could probably hear it in the interview. I'm going to be exploring this theme a bit more in future episodes of Purser Explores the World, I think. There's some topics that I want to cover and sort of dig deeper into this area. Now, before I go, for a bit of Angry Beanie housekeeping, firstly, I am in the process of organising interviews for the next episode, which will either be about the Twitch gaming service and the people who broadcast their game playing, or the history of the C word. I'm not sure which yet. Secondly, the Lunchtime Science stream will be returning to For Science in the next 2 weeks, including a new Lunchtime Science weekly podcast. Now, I've got some ideas and a basic format laid out, but we'll just see how it goes. And honestly, lastly, it just feels good to be doing this again. See you next time.